The Way Up to Heaven by Roald Dahl. All her life, Mrs. Foster had had an almost pathological fear of missing a train, a plane, a boat, or even a theatre curtain. In other respects, she was not a particularly nervous woman, but the mere thought of being late on occasions like these would throw her into a state of nerves that she would begin to twitch. It was nothing much, just a tiny, vellicating muscle in the corner of the left eye, like a secret wink. But the annoying thing was that it refused to disappear until an hour or so after the train, or plane, or whatever it was, had been safely caught. It was really extraordinary how in certain people a simple apprehension about a thing like catching a train can grow into a serious obsession. At least half an hour before it was time to leave the house for the station, Mrs. Foster would step out of the elevator all ready to go, with hat and coat and gloves, and then, being quite unable to sit down, she would flutter and fidget about from room to room until her husband, who must have been well aware of her state, finally emerged from his privacy and suggested in a cool, dry voice that perhaps they had better be going now, had they not? Mr. Foster may possibly have had a right to be irritated by this foolishness of his wife's, but he could have had no excuse for increasing her misery by keeping her waiting unnecessarily. Mind you, it is by no means certain that this is what he did. Yet, whenever they were going somewhere, his timing was so accurate, just a minute or two late, you understand, and his manner so bland that it was hard to believe he wasn't purposely inflicting a nasty private little torture of his own on the unhappy lady. And one thing he must have known, that she would never dare to call out and tell him to hurry. He had disciplined her too well for that. She must also have known that if he was prepared to wait even beyond the last moment of safety, he could drive her nearly into hysterics. On one or two special occasions, in the later years of their married life, it seemed almost as though he had wanted to miss the train, simply in order to intensify the poor woman's suffering. Assuming, though, one cannot be sure that the husband was guilty, what made his attitude doubly unreasonable was the fact, with the exception of this one irrepressible foible, Mrs. Foster was, and always had been, a good and loving wife. For over 30 years she had served him loyally and well. There was no doubt about this. Even she, a very modest woman, was aware of it, and although she had for years refused to let herself believe that Mr. Foster would ever consciously torment her, there had been times recently when she had caught herself beginning to wonder. Mr. Eugene Foster, who was nearly 70 years old, lived with his wife in a large six-story house in New York City on East 62nd Street, and they had 4 servants. It was a gloomy place, and few people came to visit them. But on this particular morning in January, the house had come alive, and there was a great deal of bustling around. One maid was distributing bundles of dust sheets to every room, while another was draping them over the furniture. The butler was bringing down suitcases and putting them in the hall. The cook kept popping up from the kitchen to have a word with the butler, and Mrs. Foster herself, in an old-fashioned fur coat and with a black hat on the top of her head, was flying from room to room and pretending to supervise these operations. Actually, she was thinking of nothing at all, except that she was going to miss her plane if her husband didn't come out of his study soon and get ready. "What time is it, Walker?" she said to the butler as she passed him. "It's 9:10, madam." "And has the car come?" "Yes, madam, it's waiting. I'm just going to put the luggage in now." "It takes an hour to get to Idlewild Airport," she said. "My plane leaves at 11. I have to be there 30 minutes beforehand for the formalities. Oh, I shall be late. I just know I'm going to be late." "I think you have plenty of time, madam," the butler said kindly. "I warned Mr. Forster that you must leave at 9:15. There's still about 5 minutes." "Yes, Walker, I know. But get the luggage in quickly, will you please?" She began walking up and down the hall, and whenever the butler came by, she asked him the time. This, she kept telling herself, was the one plane she must not miss. It had taken months to persuade her husband to allow her to go. If she missed it, he might easily decide that she should cancel the whole thing. And the trouble was that he insisted on coming to the airport to see her off. "Oh, dear God," she said aloud. Walker, I'm going to miss it. I know I'm going to miss it." The little muscle beside the left eye was twitching madly now. The eyes themselves were close to tears. "What time is it, Walker?" "It's 8:18, madam." "Now I really will I miss it," she cried. "Oh, I wish he would come." This was an important journey for Mrs. Forster. She was going all alone to Paris to visit her daughter, her only child, who was married to a Frenchman. Mrs. Forster didn't care much for the Frenchman, but she was fond of her daughter, and more than that, she had developed a great yearning to set eyes on her 3 grandchildren. She knew them only from the many photographs that she had received and that she kept putting up all over the house. They were beautiful, these children. She doted on them, and each time a new picture arrived, she would carry it away and sit with it for a long time, staring at it lovingly and searching the small faces for signs of that old, satisfying blood likeness that meant so much. And now, lately, she had come more and more to feel that she did not really wish to live out her days in a place where she could not be near these children and have them visit her and take them out for walks and buy them presents and watch them grow. She knew, of course, that it was wrong and in a way disloyal to have thoughts like these while her husband was still alive. She knew also that although he was no longer active in his many enterprises, he would never consent to leave New York and live in Paris. It was a miracle that he had ever agreed to let her fly over there alone for 6 weeks to visit them. But oh, how she wished she could live there always and be close to them. "Walker, what time is it?" 22 minutes, madam." As he spoke, a door opened and Mr. Forster came into the hall. He stood for a moment, looking intently at his wife, and she looked back at him, at this diminutive but still quite dapper old man with a huge bearded face that bore such an astonishing resemblance to those old photographs of Andrew Carnegie. "Well," he said, "I suppose perhaps we'd better get going fairly soon if you want to catch that plane." Yes, dear, yes. Everything's ready. The car's waiting." "That's good," he said. With his head over to one side, he was watching her closely. He had a peculiar way of cocking the head and then moving it in a series of small, rapid jerks. Because of this, and because he was clasping his hands up high in front of him, near the chest, he was somehow like a squirrel standing there, a quick clever old squirrel from the park. "Here's Walker with your coat, dear. Put it on." "Well, I'll be with you in a moment," he said. "I'm just going to wash my hands." She waited for him, and the tall butler stood beside her, holding the coat and the hat. "Walker, I will miss it." "No, madam," the butler said. "I think you'll make it all right." Then Mr. Foster appeared again, and the butler helped him on with his coat. Mrs. Foster hurried outside and got into the hired Cadillac. Her husband came after her, but he walked down the steps of the house slowly, pausing halfway to observe the sky and to sniff the cold morning air. "It looks a bit foggy," he said, as he sat down beside her in the car. "And it's always worse out there at the airport. I shouldn't be surprised if the flight's cancelled already." "Oh, don't say that, dear, please." They didn't speak again until the car had crossed over the river to Long Island. "I arranged everything with the servants," Mr. Foster said. "They're all going off today. I gave them half pay for 6 weeks and told Walker to send him a telegram when we wanted them back." "Yes," she said, "you told him." "I'll move into the club tonight. It'll be a nice change, staying at the club." "Yes, dear. I'll write to you. I'll call in at the house occasionally to see that everything's all right and to pick up the mail. But don't you really think Walker should stay there in the time to look after things?" she asked meekly. "Nonsense. It's quite unnecessary. And anyway, I'd have to pay him full wages." "Oh, yes," she said, "of course. What's more, you never know what people get up to when they're left alone in a house," Mr. Foster announced. And with that, he took out a cigar and, after snipping off the end with a silver cutter, lit it with a gold lighter. She sat still in the car with her hands clasped together, tight under the rug. "Will you write to me?" she asked. "I'll see," he said, "but I doubt it. You know, I don't hold with letter writing unless there's something specific to say." "Yes, dear, I know. So don't you bother." They drove on along Queens Boulevard, and as they approached the flat marshlands on which Idlewild is built, the fog began to thicken and the car had to slow down.